Hello there, Vincasters. Before I introduce this episode's amazing guest, I really want to tell you about a partnership that I've been involved with The Local Drop, a Melbourne-based online wine retailer and personalised sommelier service. And they have approached me to put together a pack of wines that I'm super excited about. I wanted to tell you about that. So if you know anything about me or the wines that I've made under the Vino Intrepido brand, you'll know that I have a great love and passion for Italian grape varieties here in Australia. And so I the first pack that I've put together includes some wines made from Italian varieties, but from some great producers like Range Life, Unico Zello, and Fighting Gully Road. And it includes one of my wines from the 2017 vintage, my Pyrenees Nebbiolo from the Malakoff Vineyard. And yeah, like I think this is a fantastic opportunity for people to try some different wines and I guess see what I'm kind of, what I think is one of the most exciting things going on in the Australian wine industry. The Italian varieties, I think, are really well suited to Australia's climate and also the styles of wine you can make from them. I think they're really delicious and honest and show great character. So if you go to the Local Drop website, which is thelocaldrop.com.au, go to collections and then click on the Intrepid Wino collections. You'll find the Italo Aussies pack for $175, which is I think it's actually recommended retail of about $250, which includes shipping. And yeah, I do hope you support the Local Drop as they are supporting me. And I hope you enjoy this week's episode. On episode 139 of the Vincast, I chat with Ashley Huntington, former winemaker and now cult Tasmanian-based brewer. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Vincast. My name is James Scarcebrook, otherwise known as the Intrepid Wino. And unfortunately, it has been a little bit of a break for the podcast. It has been a while since I've been able to find some time to sit down and have a chat with a guest. Been a lot going on, particularly in my personal life. I'm just about to get married, and so I've been obviously preparing for that. But I'm hoping to have some more time in the coming months to sit down with some more guests, because there's lots of people that I'd love to have on, and it's just a question of finding a convenient time, mutually convenient time. So I'm really excited about this episode, as it's a guest that I've wanted to have on for a number of years, and it hasn't been easy actually getting a hold of him to sit down, because I wanted to give him the opportunity to have as much time as possible to chat, because he is an incredible orator, which I found out at the first Grow Assembly a few years ago. And it is Ashley Huntington from 2 Meter Tall Brewery and Cider House, based in the Derwent Valley in Tasmania. I was recently down in Hobart and I had an opportunity to chat with him at the farm. So I do hope you enjoy our chat, because Ashley is an incredible presence and has some beautiful philosophies and makes some amazing products there. So stick around until the end to find out how to get in contact with myself and with Ashley. But until then, I'll see you on the other side. Ashley, after how many years, I think, I've finally managed to nail you down here at the farm in beautiful Derwent Valley, Tasmania.
It's been a frustration, James. Well persisted. Thank you.
And I was just thinking this morning that it's astonishing that after 130 plus episodes of this podcast, you are in fact the first brewer that I've had as a guest.
Wow.
And I think the reason is because I was like, well, I want you to be the first. So we finally got there.
And
we
you've been patient, which is patient, which is to your credit.
But I think it is certainly an indication of how in demand you are and how much people have embraced your particular approach to brewing that is indicating how busy you have been in the last couple of years.
Look, in my defence, I am often here.
I'm not.
And you're not?
I wish I was based down here sometimes.
And when you've been here, I, for various reasons, haven't been. So from my perspective, it sounds strange that you haven't been able to get me on the farm, given I spend all of my life here.
When you are in Melbourne, you are locked up with lots and lots of visits.
Yes, exactly.
But we are here, so welcome on the podcast. I start every episode by asking my guest if they can remember the first interaction they had with wine or with alcohol, probably more accurately in your case, that made them think about it in a different way and possibly set them on a path towards following a career in the industry.
Well, mine was pretty clear and I still remember it. And just a little bit of background here, I'm from my grandmother would be turning in a grave, demon drink Methodists. So no history of alcohol, really. I mean, you know, Dad used to drink beer, and but you know, there was no like much of Australia. I'm late 60s born, so that period through the 70s for sort of white Anglo Australians was, you know, sweet sherry and beer shandies and Benin Moselle. So my childhood is not at all involved in wine,
right?
At all,
and generally alcohol wasn't consumed at home. It would be at a hotel,
not at the dinner table.
Yeah,
white Anglo Australian 1970s drinking culture.
Yeah,
no wine on the table with food. Dad would drink beer. Mum might have a sherry or a Benin Moselle.
Yeah.
But you know, whilst preparing the meal, but there was no culture around food. Having said that, maternal grandma, we're dairy farming stock from Gippsland in Victoria.
Yep.
And I grew up in the dry, dusty wheat bowl of northwestern Victoria, which is sheep and cropping country.
Yep.
So I love a hill, James. Look at this. This is just perfect for me because there's hills and forest and it's just great. But we used to go on annual holidays down to grandma's, and she was a keen gardener, and even as a little boy I had some sweet corn of hers and I just couldn't believe, and I just think that flavour of that fresh grown produce anchored into me somewhere very early on, even though there wasn't that, we always ate well, but it was probably pretty badly cooked in that 1970s Australian way, meat, three veg. But growing up, and still then, a lot of people were growing their own stuff. So, you know, taste hit me quite early. I went to, first trip to Europe when I was mid-20s, gave away a job and went over to London and did a six-month cooking course.
Right, okay. And were you interested in cooking?
Yeah, well, I was interested in food and I wanted to make everything I wanted to eat.
Right.
So that was starting a journey, but it was on the food side. And then in that 6 month period, we did the WSET course, which is the London Wine Spirit Education Trust, which you're probably very familiar with, which a lot of English hospitality people do. So we did the first.
Now in Australia as well.
It's probably. Very, very, that's very, right. Very been around for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And that course involved the first one, maybe even two stages of that course.
Of course, yeah.
And I'd gone there to learn how to cook. And in one of those very early sessions, a bottle of Gigal Cote Brunie Blonde was put in front of me, and it just went bang.
Yeah.
I just took a sip and just thought, holy cow. So finished that course, came home and did a vintage at Mitchelton.
Right.
And away. I was just gobsmacked by that. Never tasted anything like it before in my life. Just got absolutely and utterly seduced. And there we go. It's a meandering journey because here I am on a farm in Tasmania making beer. so, you know, commitment levels to the cause are frayed, but I seem to be just captured. Anything that sort of captures me and takes my mind, I'm likely, unfortunately, to follow it.
Yeah.
So it was that particular glass of wine, which doesn't really explain to you why I'm making beer, but I was.
We'll come to that.
I then did a number of vintages and then went and did a postgraduate diploma at in enology at University of Adelaide.
Yep.
And then worked as a winemaker
at Roseworthy
over 10 years. Well, we were the last intake that went through Roseworthy. So we did our theory at the University of Adelaide in the Waite campus, which is now where it all happens.
Yep.
And we were the last intake to do the practical side of things up at Roseworthy.
Before it all got consolidated away.
So what was that? It was 96.
Because, mm-hmm. So my degree was, I was external, but my residential school was at Waite.
Yes, so they were converting the whole show in 96.
Yep.
And in fact, we had a group from Roseworthy's, obviously still functioning, but not in the wine front, because there was a group of 35 or something that were doing various agricultural research, visited here not so long ago, and they were from Roseworthy. So it's still a functioning thing, but not in wine. So
so you made the decision that this, had you had any particular other career pass at that point in mind?
Oh, I was honours in chemistry, and I'd
done some science,
food technology, and the last real job I had, not in the wine world, was a seriously well paying job with the Mars Corporation, making dog food snacks at the PAL factory up in Wodonga.
Wow.
Fun. And I did that for 3 years, and I could never quite convince myself. The money was very seductive for a young fella.
Sure.
But every morning we had to go in and change out of our civvies into these synthetic white uniform with a little plastic cap.
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't actually get changed and clock on by 8:30, we lost 10% of our day's pay. That's a universal, or certainly was in my time, at the Mars Corporation across all their factories. It was another world, James. So I just sort of saved up money for 3 years, and as soon as I could, I threw it in, took off to do this cooking course and travel around and follow a girl, as men are wont to do, and in England, had that bottle of wine,
right?
And bang!
Did you find that the background in chemistry and in food sciences helped as far as the studies, and then moving into
doesn't hurt.
Industry? Yeah,
it's related.
Yeah,
but that's a base degree, I suppose, and I think education has changed such that that's now reflected. Like a BSci Hons in the late 80s is now just a fairly base qualification, and in fact I had a 10-year period before I went back and did postgraduate qualifications in enology, which wasn't a bad thing, because at that stage I'd already done 2 years of vintages around the world and thought, right, I am pretty fascinated by this, I'm going to get some formal studies. But no, chemistry is a universal science, I would say to people.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't hurt. I don't think it's mandatory either. You know, there's an interest in sciencey, geeky things that's part of me. So, you know, that's not unusual to get here. But all the thing that really got me, and we can nerd on about science as you can in beer and wine for as long as you like. But there's what's particularly seduced me about food and beverage forever has been the applied agriculture.
Sure.
Coming from farming stock, we go back to that taste of my grandma's sweet corn. It's just wow, the complete subjectivity of why is that corn cob so much better than any other corn cob I've ever eaten in my life? Why?
Mm.
And can we get agreement on that? Is that a universal standard? Can that be repeated? How do we do that? What goes into it? It's the applied agriculture which fascinates me to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. How long did you work as a sort of a transient cellar hand for? You were doing vintages in Australia and in Europe, on and off.
Yeah, first one was Mitchelton, 95. And did my postgraduate studies in 96, 97. So I think I worked about four or five vintages in succession.
Mm-hmm.
And that postgraduate diploma was only a year. So had done all the vintages in Australia. Intake was in July, finished in June 1997, sorry, and then took off to Europe again to do the European vintage. So it was one of those things that you'd be familiar with, where you just, even in a vintage period, you'll try and cram in two vintages in different parts.
Yeah, yeah.
Climatically, so that you're actually, it's like vintage miles.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
So, and then very, very soon after, it was 98, so it was only a year out of graduation that I got appointed to be to run La Baume, which was Hardy's winery in the south of France. So, in a way, I'm inexperienced, but in a way, I'm not. I'm like a fresh graduate, but I'm 30.
Yeah.
So I'd had 10 years of all sorts of experiences and vintages and that sort of stuff. So, but pretty young still to get what's a pretty senior position in those days in the major wine company in Australia. So I've also done my yards in corporate winemaking too.
Yeah.
Now, let me qualify that. Probably not, because it didn't work in the corporation part in Australia. I was in France running a small show, which was so distant from the head office. It was almost literally a case of giving a young kid so much rope that he could actually hang himself.
Right.
So there was even though it was attached to the Hardy's outfit, I never really felt part of it, because my first engagement was running an overseas offshoot. So
yeah.
We were very responsible in a way for our own thing in a lot of respects. So it was I shouldn't go too hard on the corporate thing, but fascinating experience.
A little bit different to the experience with Mars.
Oh, thank God. And thank God, can I just say, dog food, come on.
was France a country that you were particularly interested in, as far as their wine?
Well, the bosses on the board would probably use an expression that I went feral in
right.
France.
Yeah,
difficult to rein somebody in when they're that far away and not involved in the daily meetings, and then you're immersed in this sort of modern winemaking in the south of France, left to your own resources. By and large, extraordinary project to be involved in as a young fella. I mean, the Languedoc has. We were at the part where this is Van de Pay Dock.
Mm-hmm.
This is 9% of the world's grapes. This is petrol bowsers of Rouge Blanc et Rosé, filled into bidons, and that's how people drank, to drink a bottled wine. This is cultural swill. Grapes everywhere. And we were trying to do this branded thing in a modern Australian way,
mm-hmm.
and in the south of France, making clean,
commercial
branded wines for basically £5,
yeah,
which is what the market, what the Australia were doing shiploads to England of that style, Nottage Hill and or whatever it was called, I've forgotten it, and Banrock Station and all those sort of Australian brands of that late 90s period when the Australian wine industry was going absolutely gangbusters.
Horton's White Burgundy.
All of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And huge press, and oh, it's great, and it's sunshine in a bottle, and it's terrific. And then one day somebody woke up and thought, it's pretty boring, though.
Yeah.
It all tastes the same.
Yeah.
And I think I'd got to that point too.
Yeah, right.
But you're in France.
Es.
So you were seeing other things.
Yeah, did you take advantage of that experience and kind of immerse yourself in the culture and the cuisine? And
enormously, enormously influential.
Yeah.
You just can't, because, and I'd often describe of France as being, and Italy would be the same, I would imagine, and Spain as well, these sort of places where my absolute interest for my entire adult life is what am I eating next? And you're all of a sudden embedded in a culture where that's normal, whereas in Australia it's not. It wasn't. It's getting more so now. But even it there it just is. It's culturally is. You eat. You stop for lunch. And there's very little pretension about it. It's just. I was to say the French would spend more on their stomach, as much on their stomach as the Englishman would spend on his car.
Yeah,
it's just a thing. And so
you said that about Germans as well.
That's right. And it's not restricted to Europe either. Probably the Japanese. You know, there's lots and lots of cultures where that is. And it's so that's when you actually intersect with that, where your life interests intersects where that's normal, hugely influential. So you're seeing things, tasting things. You know, coming from the Australian wine industry of the 90s, where the entire vineyard across the entire country looked the same trellis system, we were pruning it the same way, we were planting the same varieties from the Swan Valley down to Tasmania. It was all this, and, you know, and this is how you do it, and this is how you grow it, and this is what we do, and this tastes better. And then you'd go to the south of France, and you'd see this thing stuck in the plan de midi. These bush vines are struggling, you know, they're laden with Carignan, and the bunches are growing on the ground, and then the floods had come through, and you're picking these things up, and you just say, how on earth can this be? This is awful. God, the viticulture is terrible. And then you taste a grape, and you'd think, holy cow, why does this taste so good?
Yeah.
And it completely, so I often use the expression, I came out of university as a trained monkey winemaker, and often use silly terms like, you know, going up to a tank with the stethoscope and saying, you know, 50 parts of sulfur and a couple of grams of acid, and then you see these things that shouldn't be, that taste great, and my inclination was to follow the tastes great, not the technique that I'd been told is this is how you do it.
Yeah.
And then we would bring it in, and we'd sulfur the bin and treat the grapes supposedly properly and refrigerate the shit out of them and try not to get them oxidized, and then you'd taste the juice in the tank and you just, no, it doesn't taste like what I tasted in the vineyard.
Yeah.
And you start to question. Slow process, but it really started to, can I use the term fuck with me on here?
Yeah, absolutely.
It started to really mess with my mind. I remember one particular vineyard. I was in France doing that job for nearly 7 years, and I think I was chasing this particular patch of Sauvignon Blanc for those 7 years, and on about the sixth or seventh year, I tasted in the tank what I tasted in the vineyard. I was ecstatic. I mean, we didn't do that by conventional means. It was remarkable.
Yeah, right, okay.
So
in a way, the kind of that experience you had when you were young and tasting that raw, the raw material of the corn, and obviously wine and beer, you know, alcoholic beverages, they're a different kind of product where there is a lot more processing involved, and it doesn't necessarily taste the same, particularly when there is so much processing that is done with a lot of beverages that are produced out there. And so you wanted to capture in that beverage the same experience you had as a child tasting that corn.
Yeah, I think in fact there's an expression we use, with relation to the beer industry, where I say in the last 100, 150 years, all of the technology and processing and industrialization has led to a massive increase in the quantity that we can make, but hasn't done a goddamn thing to improve the taste. None of it. That's worth.
The improvement has been like consistency and accessibility for everyone, and
absolutely. And then across the board, whether it be an industrial process or an artisan process, that has changed the thought process. So therefore, and we still get it to this day, apparently the determinant of quality is its consistency. And I'm saying, no, that's an industrial term.
Mm.
Consistency is required in a factory. Nature doesn't do consistency. Nature does. And there's a fork in the road. So we're often now you get criticised for inconsistency. You can't follow the seasons and talk the talk of consistency and then not interpret what you're given each season. And at that fork in the road, I turned emphatically towards the taste. Emphatically.
And it would have been an important part of the experience was doing it over time and over a number of years and sort of seeing how each year was different and every season in that each year things change. And you are like that. If nature was consistent, we wouldn't have four seasons. We'd have the same weather every day. You know, the land would be flat. We'd all eat the same thing. But that's not the way nature is. But what I find nature provides, not rather than consistency, is balance. But the balance moves.
Well, and if you graph this, it'd be like some sine curve.
Yeah.
Now,
ups and downs aren't bad.
The consistency argument puts a modulation on that sine curve, which, if that is the goal, that is a good design. But the counter thought process to that is that you are not only limiting the troughs, you are cutting the potential peaks.
Yes.
We can make the same argument with things like Spotify, for example, and music. The data file trims bits so that it's all downloadable and all very... And then you go back and you put a vinyl on. And I hadn't had my vinyl player for 25 years for various reasons of moving around and all that sort of stuff. And I remember, and I set it up about 10 years ago when we came down to Tasmania, and I put this old vinyl record on. And for goodness me... It felt like the musical equivalent that I'd been eating McDonald's for 25 years.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I heard all of these bits in these songs, the full file. So you can't always, you know, there is a place for both. I'm not saying we don't do that consistency because it's wrong. We don't do consistency because that's not what we're trying to do.
But at the same time, you're also not making a product for the entire population.
No.
And I think that's with things like corporate consolidation and sort of attempting to get consistency and look boiling down things down to the lowest common denominator. You know, that kind of dulls everything, but that's for the big market. That's for the big part of the population. And I think, I mean, obviously in terms of music, recently obviously Aretha Franklin just passed away. And one thing I heard people say a number of times was, you know, when she recorded that music, she actually had to do the singing. There was no manipulation of her voice. They literally would just turn a microphone on and she sang into that microphone and they recorded it and that's it. And there is something kind of beautiful about that that is sort of a bit lost. As far as the more often than not, you know, it's live music, and even that you can kind of play around with. I mean, and live music is kind of it's relative when you look at the culture of DJs and the fact that they're not actually playing music live. But anyway,
I can't speak to Aretha personally, but I would imagine that is more the definition of her stardom.
Mm.
Than the records she produced and the sales she achieved. For the people that actually saw that,
yes,
and heard that, and her ability up close to do those sorts of things, that would have marked them. And I think therein lies what she was rather than the commercial success, for example, that she was able to achieve. I don't know whether that metaphor is going through, but that's what I'm thinking. So if the thing that struck me the most was here we were, and I still describe winemaking as the very best example of value-added farming.
Yeah.
So it's one of the few, in my experience, particularly in Australia, it's one of the few occasions where the farmer grows, produces, and takes the product to the market. So these black things behind you, these cows, most beef farmers in Australia are producing a product which they trade amongst themselves, sale yards.
Yep.
My father was involved in the livestock industry for his entire working life, and I doubt whether he ever met a chef.
Yeah.
And I find that gobsmacking, strange, and telling.
Mm.
Because
let alone the final consumer who is actually eating.
Let alone the final consumer. So where's the... At some point, there is a complete and utter separation and disjuncture in what should be a fluid line from farm to end user. Now, that is changing at a small end of the market, which is great. But by and large, I still think, by and large, winemaking has been and still is an extremely good example of farmers taking their product to market. And if you're dealing with an individual farmer, say, and we talk vintages and seasons, and the 2017 was amazing and the 2016 it rained a lot, and so therefore we almost talked that down. But that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point, James.
Mm-hmm.
We have to, there shouldn't be any, this is, and I'm not saying that that brings an acceptance of low quality product, whatever that means. I'm really starting to interrogate the entire judgmental system attached to that whole mindset. Person, place, season, hard labour, product, and then, you know, some sort of arrogant dismissal of, you know, a bit washed out or whatever, you know, whatever it means. It, to me, it just doesn't seem right. And it's got too much traces of arrogance attached to it as well. Well, you come here and try and deal with that.
And speaking myself personally, now that I've had, you know, a couple of vintages of making some of my own wine, such as it is, you know, I'm not growing it. I obviously would love that opportunity, but I'm purchasing grapes and I'm making decisions about how I want the wines to be. Having had a background working both in retail and obviously I still do work in wholesale, and you know, having wine submitted to me for me to taste and talk about, when I'm taking something that I've made to that market, I do realize that there is that kind of, it's so easy to pass judgment on something. It's so easy to, and it's not like to put something in front of someone and they say, oh, you know, it's such and such, I'm not, you know, that interested, but, you know, come back next year kind of thing. I can then take that same wine to someone else and they might love it.
That's it.
And that it, like, so the kind of, I find it fascinating that there is this constant seeking out of objectivity.
Yes.
When you are assessing something, you can't be objective because ultimately you are looking at something based on your experiences. You are comparing things. It's based on a certain framework that you have developed in your mind, whether consciously or not. And ultimately, someone else might have a different experience and assess and see things in something that you might not. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong either. So
precisely.
Why is this constant trying to achieve this consistency, this conformity, this mitigation of the ups and downs of life and nature.
Unless that is at the basis of your project. If that's, if you want to produce a consistent product,
sure,
absolutely. And if that become, and if that is a goal, go for it. Speak to it. Do it.
Yeah.
You want to produce something that tastes the same every year? That is a skill in itself.
But don't tell. But don't tell me that I'm wrong.
But don't judge somebody else who doesn't do that on that criteria.
Yeah.
Because it's irrelevant. So we can't have universalisms.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. So therefore, as a producer, the role of the producer is always to explain what it is they do.
Yes.
And to the best and most honest of our ability. So that, because in fact, that also brings in the enjoyment.
Yes.
And particularly at the individual artisan level, selling into individual places who are looking for that sort of thing, an entire repartee starts, which is captivating in that field, but is probably not the product that we want to expand if we're looking for volume.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden we reach a clash point.
Yeah.
So horses for courses, you know?
But ultimately, and whether it is a cow or some corn or whether it's grapes or, something that you are converting from a raw agricultural product, whether you are a winemaker or a brewer or a chef, ultimately you are enjoying it on its merits, but that is part of the process is to contextualize and to sort of, because it's the same thing when you go to a restaurant and you say, oh, the chef has prepared it this way kind of thing.
That's right.
Sort of thing, oh, that adds value to the experience, because ultimately all we have in life is experiences. We can't take anything with us when we go. So that kind of, those are the experiences that I seek out. And when you say, I tasted this piece of meat and it made me think about all these different things, I still carry that experience with me 20 years later. That is the true life. Yeah. That is the true value of life is experience.
And back to the French experience. I will never forget. We were having a visitation from a group of clients from England. They came in and there was a busload of them or whatever it was, and we were preparing visit and lunch and all this sort of stuff. And my secretary comes into my office and says, I've just got the fax in from the group that's coming next week, and there's a few people that have indicated that that they don't eat meat. And I said, I'll be vegetarian, so it'll be fine. We'll accommodate that. And she just looked at me and she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, they don't eat meat, so we'll have a couple of dishes on the side that don't contain meat, and that'll be fine." And she's still standing there. She just didn't get the concept.
Yeah.
She said, what do you mean they don't eat meat, but they're coming here? They'll eat what we make them.
Yeah.
And I looked at her and I just thought, you've never encountered this before, have you?
Yeah.
Where you're actually faxing, and that puts a date on it. You're actually faxing forward what you will tolerate and what you won't to a place that you're visiting.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's, I don't know. That's not a judgment or anything on vegetarianism or whatever.
No. Yeah.
But isn't it an interesting concept? And that's what she was floored by, was the fact that somebody would actually, I'm coming to visit you and I won't eat this, do that. I want it to be like this. Hang on a minute. You're coming to see us.
Yeah.
But isn't it our role to show you what we do and then you can politely say, you know.
I'll decline, yeah.
There's no obligation that you... Do you understand what I mean?
It was.
That was a real... there was somebody who... And that I described... That was a fairly cultural experience.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that's universally French or whatever, but just to see that in the region that we were and to hear that and be faced by that, I thought it was quite fascinating.
Yeah, right. So what was the journey from the wine industry into your interest in beer and then your particular interest in beer that has ended up with 2 Minute Tall?
James, it's this is where it all goes a bit pear-shaped. You see that hill behind us up here?
Yes.
That is the best vineyard site.
You've spoken fondly of this hill.
That is the best vineyard site I have ever encountered.
Without a vineyard on it.
This 2.5 hectare north-facing slope, which is north off south, which is very important in Tasmania, and underneath that lovely soil is a sandstone base, which is just it is an outstanding vineyard site. It was inconveniently attached to 600 hectares. So I've come to Tasmania and I've done 6 months research and I have a huge distinction between southern Tasmania and northern Tasmania. And I had been following, I'd come to Tasmania and done a vintage in 1998 because I'd tasted a Heemskerk Gewürztraminer. Sorry, I got it wrong. Steve Lubiana made a Gewürztraminer and I had that at Stella, which is Jeff Lindsay's restaurant, which was pretty tops in the late '90s, and I had never tasted anything like this in a wine, and I just thought, wow, that is extraordinary. I immediately down to Tasmania. Where's that come from? Mm. How's that? You know, that's remarkable. Flavors, and got myself hooked on Tasmania because in those years leading up to that, hadn't been to Tasmania. Tasmanian flavours were still significantly different from anywhere else in Australia. I mean, you know, we talk about regional differences between McLaren Vale and Coonawarra and la 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 la. Tasmania was remarkably different.
Mm.
And I stepped off the plane, did a vintage at what is now Bay of Fires, which was Roshcombe, independent thing, just because at that stage, most of Tasmanian grapes were going to Domaine Chandon as grapes, so there wasn't much wine making in Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, ooh, good, that's the jumping off point. That's where they collate all the grapes from all over the state and they ship them to Domaine Chandon. And I'll work there so I can taste every bin of grapes coming from every vineyard in Tasmania. And therefore convinced myself after that experience that the south was where we need to be. As the flavours were. And then promptly went to France. I'm coming back though. This is where we need to be in Australia. This is just great. So, you know, disappeared to France and then started, you know, itchy feet 7 years later, 8 years later, whatever it had been at the Boehm. The company was being sold and all that sort of jazz. Mergers and acquisitions, James.
Mm-hmm.
Very big winemaking thing. And I hadn't, not 2004. I don't. We got bought and the company got bought and sold twice. I don't think I tasted a grape that year. I was too busy dealing with the financial machinations of the business end of the thing. Anyway, so it came back, and spent 6 months and looked at 150 properties in the south of Tasmania. I've still got the folder, and settled on that for that hill. And I was going to plant. I wanted a specific clone of Syrah. From the, because people say, you know, Tasmania, Burgundy, bullshit. Ever been to Burgundy? Nothing like it. Absolutely nothing like it. Nothing like anything in Europe. But if there is somewhere that it might be vaguely similar to, it's sort of like the northern end of the Rhone. And so I wanted this particular clone, and I managed to get it off Yves Curion's Conrieux vineyard. That is the structure and the Pinot Noir and the Derwent Valley, which has got this beautiful blackberry core of fruit. I was going to hang that fruit on the structure from this. I'm going to plant 10,000 vines to the hectare. No trellising. Amazing project.
Mm.
A lot of work. How's it going, James? 15 years later, there's a cow up there.
helping prepare.
Goodness gracious, me. Well, the point is, I 15 years later, no vineyard in the ground, and I'm now brewing beer. Something happened, And I'm just going to default to the Italian setting, which is the old boy will come out and he'll say, this is a place where you should grow olives. This on this hill here, you should grow grapes. And on these flats here, you should grow zucchini. It's a statement of agricultural fact. Whether you plant it or not, it doesn't matter. If you did, that's what you would do on that, because that's the place to do that.
Yep.
And I often jokingly contrast that with the Australian way, which is we buy 10-acre soldier settlement block at Toolybuck and try to convince everyone that that's the best place on earth to grow the grape. Put in the vineyard and then try and tell everybody that that's the best place on earth to grow the wine. That is a statement of economics. Because I've got to make a living and la, 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 la. You see, so there's a difference. So,
and we'll plant 10 different varieties and, you know, so we've got something for everyone. And
something for everyone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But we'll say every variety. Oh, we make the best of that variety in the whole region.
Because I've got kids to feed and I've, you know, la, la, la. Whereas the other one is just, so I'm just 15 years, 600 hectare farmer, far too big, got the perfect vineyard site, haven't done a bloody thing. So I have no option but to default to the agricultural. That is a ripping vineyard site. But just across the road here, just across the Derwent River and the other side of the road, there's hops. I'd never seen a hop in my life before. And I, what are they, the hops? Hops. Beer. Like beer.
Never seen one. A lot of wine made with a lot of beer.
The agricultural history of the Derwent Valley is hop growing, not grape growing. So from New Norfolk, which you drove past, all the way to Westaway and all up the tributaries of the Styx and the Lachlan and the Molesworth Valley, you came here in 1968, the year I was born. There were 169 hop growers in the Derwent Valley. Schools used to close during hop harvest so that the kids could go out and help with the hop, bring the hop harvest in. That's the agricultural history of this particular part of the world.
So is there a particular reason why the Derwent Valley was planted so heavily to hops? What is it about this part of the world that maybe is so good for growing hops?
This is going to shock your listeners. Let's indulge in a little bit of Australian ignorance, because the Derwent Valley is the sunniest, one of the sunniest parts of Australia.
Right.
In midsummer, we have 18-hour days.
Yep.
And hops respond to day length.
Right.
Principally.
Photosynthesis.
Many others, but so the Derwent Valley, and particularly here, just where we're sitting, you can see that the sun is, we're September. In midwinter, it barely gets above the hills. Now it's at about 45 degrees angle. By January, the sun is directly overhead, and we're sitting out in the middle of the Derwent Valley, and it rises in the east. And it sets in the west, and it goes straight overhead, and it's a long day, and that's what hops need. And so that's.
So it's not necessarily climactic.
Yes, yeah, but it's principally day length. There's a number of other agricultural factors, but principally it's day length.
Right.
Once the soil temperature gets to right now, they're coming out of the ground. And nothing will stop the bastards until...
So being that we are so far south, that is one of the... Okay, interesting.
And so...
So you saw these hops and found out that... what I remember you quoting a number of years ago, 80 or 90% of all the hops grown in Australia are grown in the Derwent Valley.
Our farm's been operating since 1830.
Yeah.
It's grown hops. That's all it's grown. And the Derwent Valley since the 1850s was growing 80%, if not more. It's a little bit less these days because they're growing a bit in Myrtleford in Victoria.
Yep,
that's the other region. But right up until the 60s and 70s, the Derwent Valley was growing hops. The only use for hops is beer. The only use for hops is beer. We do other things with grapes. We don't do anything with hops except flavour beer.
Mm.
1830s, I got here in 2004, it's 175 years-ish.
Mm-hmm.
It's the agriculture of the Derwent Valley, 169 small family farmers growing hops along the Derwent River in 1968. Only use for the product is beer.
So
never been a brewery in the Derwent Valley, ever.
Tasmania famously has, you know, a number of breweries in the case of Bogues and Cascade.
Two. But technically, Cascade might be on... No, it's not. The Derwent?
Yeah.
Look.
But as far as in the region itself, in the Derwent Valley itself...
You go to Coonawarra and the closest winery is in Millicent.
Mm.
They're growing all those grapes. It's all they do is grow grapes in the Coonawarra.
Mm.
And you're driving through there and you say to somebody, Cabernet Sauvignon, wow, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
You go, can I get a glass of wine with my dinner? And they're looking at you saying, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're growing all these grapes. Surely you make some wine. No. Mate, we're grape growers.
Yeah.
I just, as a winemaker, and I've just said to you, best example of value-added farming in the country, as a winemaker, that was one of these gong, what the fuck moments.
Yeah.
And I just thought, and I smelt a hop for the first time, rubbed it between my, oh, and just thought, I've never smelt that in a beer. That is amazing.
Yeah.
Imagine that. This is 2004. This is before the, this is well before
the craft beer craze,
right now. There's 50 breweries and small breweries in Australia at that stage. This, And Bushy Park wasn't in good fettle, and I've got thoroughly distracted. Absolute. While my vines are growing, James, I'm going to make a beer because it can't be that hard. Because, and here's one of the biggest social snobby wrongs in the food and beer is just give me a beer. I'm thirsty. And then when I want to be sophisticated, I'll have a glass of wine. What is the difference between a hop and a bunch of grapes at an agricultural level? About $50 a bottle.
Mm.
It's, what is it about the grape? You smell that perfume. It is amazing. It is... at least as good as the perfume in a lot of grape. I got, with no experience, had never made a beer in my life, absolutely no idea, I'm going to make a beer. I'm not qualified, I went to brewing school, know nothing about it. It's fermented, what is it? It's fermented grain. Cool. I can ferment stuff. It's easy. Except I made a very, very fundamental mistake, James. There's the hops. There's the water in the river. And I got this bloody big farm that I haven't planted my vineyard. I'm going to grow some grain. So I did. Put 80 hectares of barley in. Before I even knew that you had to malt the barley before you brewed it. Yield. Barley coming out my ears. And it's not business 101, this. It really, it's just meandering. And I made every mistake in the book. And here we are. So 15 years later, I'm still hacking away at making beer because it is fascinating. I'm lost. Completely lost.
I remember you'd saying at Grow Assembly a few years ago, like one of the other fundamental questions you were asking about beer was why are we controlling the core of what beer is, which is the fermentation, the brewing? Why are we controlling it using chemistry, using science, using cultured yeast? Why can't we wild ferment beers? Why can't we do that?
Because for the last 100 years, that's where the beer market has gone. And not only has the beer market in Australia been controlled by a limited number of corporations for whom that is essential, it has controlled the entire thought process around the product. and therefore their beer was a singular noun. I would like a beer.
Mm.
The idea of variation, or there was no such thing as a Cabernet Sauvignon and a Shiraz and a Chardonnay of beer. It was just a beer.
Yeah.
A brand. Might have been a dark beer if you were feeling particularly adventurous.
Yeah.
But even that was made like a blonde beer with a bit of dark stuff chucked in.
Yeah.
And it controlled the thought. It controlled the thought and the expectation and everything. Everything. So, Bugger Lugs here, completely divorced from the beer world, has no association with it at all, doesn't know the language, doesn't know how to do it, just seen this agricultural product across the river, has a dip, just smacked headlong into a century or more of established thought and process. And the feedback loop was intense.
Mm.
There you go. But I tell you what, here's a glass of beer. James takes a sip. Oh, I like that. Can you do that? I'll have that one again. What? You want that? You want it again? Yeah. Just like that. How about I give it a bit of this and do it? No. I want that one. If I had to do that, there's no way I would be still making beer. The vineyard would be in and I'd be off back doing what I did. If I had to adhere, I don't think I could have done it for a start, but getting lost in what I think is significantly more fascinating fermentations than I ever encountered in winemaking.
Mm.
The diversity of beer fermentations when they are wild is extraordinary, captivating, fascinating, and it completely fucked with my karma and everything I thought I knew. And I haven't yet emerged. I am just as captivated by it today as I was when the first thing went wrong and I thought, what happened there? It is a remarkable process. I mean, if I had to modulate it and cut it down and do it industrially to produce a product for mass appeal, not 10% as interesting.
Mm.
And I would have, as you can tell, I've suffered from distraction. I would have wandered off somewhere else and done, you know what I mean? This has gripped me for longer than I've ever been gripped by anything.
Mm. The other thing that I remember you talking about was the process of filtration and that stripping so much good stuff out of the product. And I've had several guests on the podcast. Sharon, who also spoke at Grow Assembly, and she obviously makes beautiful fermented foods and non-alcoholic beverages, and Campbell Burton, who specifically mentioned your product and their promotion of good bacteria and good gut health. And I think that is another really fundamental part of the way that you are approaching your product, the way that you are brewing and getting that in front of people. And I know it's you can be very cynical and say, oh yeah, drinking beer is good for your health kind of thing. It's like, well, you know, everything in moderation, of course, but there is good bacteria and that promotes good health in your body.
Look, a natural fermentation process of a grain-based, and we all accept that for those that don't have issues with gluten and bits and pieces, that bread is sourdough bread, wild fermented bread, is a magnificent food product. Beer is a liquid form of sourdough bread in the way we do it. You've got to remember, grapes, for example, is sugar. glucose and fructose in grapes, and that's basically 99% of the constituents of chemical constituent of the fermentables in the grape. It's pretty simple fermentation. I mean, I am deliberately playing that down because it's a lot more complicated than that at another level. But beer, you're starting with the starch in the grain. And we have to make the sugars through a conversion process.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by nature imperfect. And so we're left with all sorts of bits and pieces. So as a substrate, the wort, which is the beer equivalent of must, is so much more complicated than wine. And then if you let... if you control that and just put in a specific yeast and to the exclusion of all others, you get a result, which is, by and large, most of the beers that people drink, and that's fine. But it's not over unless you maintain the integrity of that one yeast or selected yeast system. But if you do what we do and don't maintain the integrity, i.e. you allow nature to unfold, you get the most complex bevy of organisms chewing into this thing, because there is food for all of them. And it's yeast, bacteria, and then the wild yeasts, and they come in phases. And what you're referring to is specifically lactobacillus, lactic acid-producing bacteria. And they are known as probiotics, because anything that lactobacillus has acted on is rendered immediately and significantly more digestible to the human body.
Mm.
Sauerkraut, you name it, kimchi, kefirs, they're all as a result of lactobacillus fermentation, and the human body is particularly receptive to that and finds all of that much more digestible.
Mm.
That's where all this good health probiotic stuff comes from. And guess what? The naturally occurring microorganism on the surface of all grain-based plants is not yeast, it is lactobacillus. So to allow, that's where the word sourdough comes from, because lactobacillus converts, works on the enzyme-modified starch and produces lactic acid bacteria, hence the sour.
Mm.
And the point is, therefore, beer in its natural state, allowed to naturally ferment, allows those organisms to go to work. And at the whole, at the completion of that, and by the way, the entire fermentation of that wort, beer equivalent of must, takes 3 years to unfold, at least. And at the end of that, without any filtration, any preservatives, anything whatsoever, we emerge at the end of that product with a food product that has been digested by countless thousands of different types of organisms, is absolutely safe, is absolutely preserved in time, and has an acidic content which allows it to age like any fine wine. It is a remarkable product. And, James, there are no books on this. I encountered this with no knowledge, just by fumbling around in a tin shed on a farm, doing something that I didn't know what I was doing. And we have enlightened ourselves to a thing that is an exceptional food product. Yes, it's beer.
Or cider.
Or cider, but in the way the market interprets beer and cider, those two concepts that I've just breathed are just light years apart from where beer had come commercially, and what we've stumbled into here. That is, changes beer from this singular noun into a plural word. And what a dramatically plural word it is. So somebody else can plant the vineyard, because I am I'm not. I'm lost in beer. Lost. Forever.
And that's probably part of the reason it took me so long to actually sit down with you and record the podcast, because you've been lost in the beer, as it were. I could continue chatting with you all day. Already it's been one of the longer episodes that I've recorded. So unfortunately I'm going to have to cut it short there. But I do highly encourage everyone to seek out more information about what Ashley's doing down here in the Derwent Valley. And even better, come and visit the farmhouse and taste some beer from a natural tap, not of this, you know, gas controlled, temperature controlled.
No, just as it is.
Proper farmhouse
live ale.
And have a chat with Ashley and find out more, because it's really exciting. I think that it's fantastic that there is a lot more embracing of this side of brewing in Australia now. Certainly, you know, in the trade in Melbourne, a lot of my customers, they're embracing beer in a way not unlike wine. In the same way that they're embracing sake, in that way that like they are enjoying this kind of this rawness, this realness, this natural energy in the product.
Well, kudos to you for your persistence, and but also kudos to you and your generation of professionals in the industry. You work in wine, and yet you have persisted to try and interview me and come all the way out here to my farm in Tasmania to do this, and it's not wine. And that is a remarkable change in the way younger people are thinking about food and wine in Australia today. It's encouraged by people like yourselves, food and beverage professionals, new restaurants.
Chefs.
The whole thing is at a level of excitement and can do that this country has never seen.
And thankfully, it is trickling down to the consumers themselves.
I hope so.
Trickling.
Trickling, but that's, look, let's face it, we can only trickle because we make this ourselves and it runs out.
Yep.
We get back to where we started the discussion. The volume will supply the market and we will supply the colour and interest at the level that we can. And so, thank you. That is indicative of these exciting new beverages and exciting new times. And it's a fascinating moment to be doing all this sort of stuff.
An exciting new Tasmania.
Ah, Tassie's just great. Always has been.
I love coming down here. But Ashley, thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
I will provide links as far as websites, social media, that kind of thing. But like I say, do check out 2 Meter Tall. If you do see Ashley, he's pretty hard to miss. He is indeed 2 meters tall. So if you see him out, do go and introduce yourself and let him know that you heard him on the podcast. But thank you, Ashley, and I look forward to enjoying many, many more beers in the future.
Really appreciate your time. Thanks, James.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to this rather extended episode of the Vincast. I have been James Scarcebrook, otherwise known as the Intrepid Wino. You can find out more information about 2 Meter Tall Farmhouse Ale and Cider at the website 2MT, that's the number 2MT.com.au, and you'll find links to social media there as well. You can find me on social media on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm at Intrepid Wino. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at The Vincast. You can also find me on YouTube, Intrepid Wino, one word, lots of different videos there. I think I have looked at one of Ashley's former products on there, the Snake Bite, I think it was, which was awesome. And please do subscribe, leave a comment, like some videos, share them on social media, and make sure to leave a comment because I'd love to hear from you. You can also subscribe to the podcast on a number of different platforms, including iTunes, the podcasts app, new Google Podcasts app, Stitcher, Player FM, Podbean, iHeartRadio. It's on Spotify now. Subscribing to the podcast means you get the newest episode as soon as it becomes available. You can access the full back catalogue. And it's also a great way to provide some feedback. So please do take some time to leave a rating and review if you enjoyed this or any other episode of the podcast, as I really do appreciate the feedback, and it also helps grow the audience. All the information there is available on my website, intrepidwino.com, as well as information about my little wine brand and lots of different writings I've done in the past. But guys, until next episode, bye.
Earbuds, Melbourne's podcast network. Earbudsnetwork.com.